You're listening to the Holocaust Educational Trust podcast series. The Trust works with schools, colleges, and communities across the United Kingdom to educate about the Holocaust and its contemporary relevance. To learn more about our programs for teachers and students, visit us online at het.org.uk. From the Holocaust Educational Trust, I'm Alex Maws, and this is the 70 Voices podcast. 70 Voices is a digital commemorative project from the Holocaust Educational Trust, marking 70 years since the end of the Holocaust by documenting its history through 70 unique sources. Follow the project as it unfolds online at 70voices.org.uk or download the 70 Voices app, available for most smartphones and tablets. This week's content on 70 Voices has addressed the persecution of Jews in Germany and Austria through the law, propaganda, and increasingly violence by the Nazis before the Second World War. And we're privileged this week to be joined by someone who experienced these events firsthand, Harry Bibring. Harry was born in Vienna in 1925. Harry, thank you very much for joining the podcast this week.
To be here.
And could you start by telling us a little bit about your life before the Nazis?
Well, before the Nazis, of course, I was a child because when the Anschluss and the Nazis came, I was just turned 12 years old. My life at that time was a very comfortable life. My father had one shop, but it was a very successful shop. And as a result of that, we had a very nice flat, and we lived in a comfortable, a nice district, and I really had everything I wanted. But my main pleasures at the time, in the winter, was to ice skate. I was a very keen ice skater, and I was pretty proficient at it for my age, and I spent a lot of time ice skating. But I also have good memories of going with my parents on Sundays, which was the only day my father's shop was closed, around the Vienna Woods, so famously known. And we did a lot of hiking and going around the cafe houses up there. And that was a pleasure in the spring and autumn, which I also very much remember.
So you were 7, I think, when the Nazis came to power across the border from Germany. When did you first become aware of what was happening to Jewish people there?
Not until I was involved. I have to admit that I was not a very studious boy, and ice skating was far more important in school to me, and consequently it was a bit of a shock when I found that Austria had been annexed to Germany, where I heard some rumors, people you hear adults talking, that anti-Semitism was far worse over there than it has been here. And by saying that, I'm implying and meaning that I wasn't unused to anti-Semitism, because, of course, Austria was already ruled by a right-wing fascist government from 1936 onwards. And whilst I didn't understand it at the time, I know now that a number of things were already in force where Jews couldn't participate. For example, very soon after Dolph was in 1930, I don't know when, a law was passed that it was impossible for a Jew to hold a public paid appointment. So civil servants or teachers' jobs were no longer able to be carried out. But I didn't know any of that. I only know it now because I'm an adult. I didn't really take on. And I heard people talk about concentration camps. First I thought that they were talking about holiday camps, and then I found out they're not holiday camps. They're people where people don't get much to eat and they work very hard. And that was it. It was a very skimmed knowledge that I had of what was going on in Germany.
Mm. And one of the sources that 70 Voices, our app, had online this week, and that our listeners may have had a chance to read before they heard this podcast, addressed the issue of violence against Jews in Vienna, which accompanied the Anschluss, the Union of Germany and Austria in March 1938. So what was your experience at this time? Do you remember the violence?
Well, I remember the violence mostly after during on 10th of November, the Kristallnacht. In fact, on the 10th of November, I witnessed the first piece of what I regard as violence, anyway, or behavior, that's the scrubbing of the pavements of Jews, because I saw that whilst we were being taken onto house arrest. And I really found this most abhorrent, particularly because the groups that I saw included very Orthodox Jews in their full garb of full dress and long beards and so forth. And these are people that I would stand generally as clear of. They're like saints, and I don't want to be really involved with them. And here they were being degraded, kicked, beards pulled, sideburns pulled, bleeding, some of them playing football with their hats. It was probably that was the biggest insult to them of all, because they liked to keep their hats covered and so forth. And that was my introduction to any violence that I actually witnessed.
And so we've also seen on 70 Voices this week how the Nazis used the law to discriminate against Jews. How did your life change in the months following Anschluss?
Well, the first thing that happened was within about 4 weeks of the Anschluss, which was my ice rink, which I called my ice rink, being closed to Jews. And I couldn't understand that at all. I didn't understand what being Jewish had to do with ice skating. And I had to have that explained to me by my parents, that this new regime, this new government, will make laws and edicts which will affect us, and this is one of them. And I really considered it the end of my life if I can't ice skate on my ice skating rink or what is it. And the only consolation I had was that it was early April, and the ice skating season finishes when the spring gets warm, and no particular date, but around about April, there weren't many weeks left for ice skating. And my parents sort of said, well, maybe by the time the next season comes, this government will be gone again, and so forth. But of course, that was silly.
And this violence, of course, culminated in the horrors of Kristallnacht, the November pogrom of 1938. What happened to your family?
Well, to put it in a nutshell, I didn't know it when it happened, but on the actual day of the 10th of November, my father was arrested on his way to opening his business, and spent about 10 to 12 days, I don't remember the exact number of days, in a jail, in a prison, a jail for convicts, in a cell packed with 11 other Jews, and we didn't know that until he was released. 10 or 11 days later, in a terrible state. And my sister and my mother, we were collected from our flat that we lived in and put into a sort of a house arrest. We were taken to somebody else's flat, which was very large, where there were lots of other women and children, and they were kept. And the object undoubtedly was that they'd created these pockets of 30 women and children in various parts of the city, so that they knew that where they were in groups when they wanted to do anything with them. But as far as I know, nobody knows what actually happened after that, because the vast majority of these groups were sent home after about 10 days, and nothing further happened to them. Although I believe some went into concentration camps. And similarly, my father was released from this jail and came home at about the same time.
Mm-hmm. And I remember from having heard you speak in a school before, and I've heard you tell some of your story before, that you were, after that, you know, it was quite alarming, and shortly after that you came to the UK. Can you talk about the circumstances, about how
my father, while he was in jail, his shop, like all other, practically all other shops, were destroyed. Although I know now that it was an attempt to Aryanize my father's shop in July, which I didn't know at the time. And I don't know why I found some documents in the archives of Viennese National Archives, which actually show the application of the Aryanization of my father's shop. But what I don't know is why it didn't go through. And because it didn't go through, it was destroyed and looted. And so my father had no income. And what's more, he had very little income from the Anschluss onwards, onwards, because he had a notice and had to have a notice required by law to show that this was a Jewish proprietor. So and this, the shop was in a district where there weren't many Jewish people living, so his customers were mainly non-Jewish, and his business went down by pretty much income. So we came to the point where my father wasn't earning a living, and we were living above our means for the last few months. So the point came to that we've got to emigrate. And I was very pleased to hear this, because I had just about enough of that. And I was coming up to my 13th birthday. The initial idea that my parents told my sister and I we would do is to go to Shanghai. That was a plan that didn't go through, because the person who actually was responsible for making it possible for Jews to go to Shanghai was the Shanghai consul in Vienna, who was actually stopped by the Shanghai authorities to continue doing this. And so we were probably just a bit too late. And then later on, my parents told us that they heard of this plan of what people now call the kinder transport, where we, my sister and I, would come to England, and immediately in England, with groups of people, my parents would go to the British consulate in Vienna and say, we have two children living in England, and they are being looked after by strangers. They won't look after them forever. So we need a visa to come to England so that our children don't become a burden on the British state. Of course, that was a dream, and it wasn't invented by my parents. Lots of parents had the same idea, but it didn't work, of course.
So you came to Britain on the kinder transport, and your parents were left in Austria. What happened to them?
Well, my father lived on behind when the war started. The next thing that happened to my parents after we'd gone is their flat was our flat where I was born was Aryanized, and they had to move to rooms, and then they had to move out of the district because the district we lived in was declared a Jew-free zone, so they had to go to a totally different district and still live in rooms. And in November 1940, all this information, incidentally, I only learned after the war. In November 1940, my father was taken from these rooms to, this time, really go to a concentration camp, and left my mother behind because they dealt with men first. And my father had a weak heart for many years. I remember in the 30s, he was in the sanatoria and so forth. And he had a heart attack in that van as soon as that happened, and died in the van. So the body was brought back for my mother to bury, and therefore he was the luckier of the two, because he lies in a proper grave, in a proper cemetery in the city of Vienna, like a human being. That left my mother alone. She moved in with her sister, whose husband also died. I have not been able to establish the circumstances of his death. And the two women eventually, in June 1942, were transported to a camp which is very very little known. It's called Itzbica. Itzbica was a holding pen, which was used like a feeding pot for the extermination camps. When the extermination camps wanted more Jews, they drew them from Itzbica, and my mother and her sister eventually went. I say eventually, I have no idea how long they were in Itzbica. I sincerely hope from my heart it wasn't long, because it must have been a terrible place. And then they were transported to Sobibor, one of the extermination camps, where they both died in June 1942.
Mm. Harry, on this podcast, it's really just we're getting sort of a very condensed version of your much longer and more complex and incredibly fascinating story. I know it's actually available online through the Shoah Foundation.
Indeed,
you can yours is one of the ones that's I think publicly available, and I would encourage our listeners to go have a look at that. We will put a link online to that so people can see that. Just to wrap up, this week's theme, as I said, has been life before the war for Jews. And I think for Holocaust educators, we feel it's so important that you can't really understand the magnitude of the loss unless you know something about what was there beforehand. And I know when you speak, you spend a lot of time talking about life before the war. Why do you find that it's important to tell students about, you know, ice skating and things like that?
Well, in a nutshell, I feel that the century that I spent most of my life in, the 20th century, was very amiss of having learnt any lessons from the Holocaust itself. And throughout the 20th century, there had been genocides after genocides, smaller numbers of people killed, maybe, but that's I don't think you can measure genocide by the number of people killed. And therefore, I go to the 21st century students in their classes and tell them that you are the people of the 21st century, and you've got to learn to stop to discriminate against other people simply different. I don't use the word racism very much. I believe we are a human race, and there's only one race on this planet, and it should live happily and peacefully with each other wherever they may be. And that dream can only come true if people actually take this very seriously and stop discriminating and differentiating between people because they are different by whatever description you would care to mention, skin color, religion, ways of culture, whatever. We all want to be different. We should stay different, but accept our differences in peace. And I won't be here to see it, but I'll look down from above and see that it gets in order, maybe in the 22nd century.
Harry, and your story, I think, is one of so many of the survivors who and refugees who go to speak in schools, that it gives that personal dimension to Holocaust education. And I think seeing you in a classroom or hearing you on a podcast or online, it helps to you know, highlight those exact lessons that you're talking about. Once people make that personal connection, they see it's not just sort of these abstract statistics, but human stories. A young boy who had a family with a shop, who lived in a particular community, who enjoyed certain pastimes and ice skating that we talked about, that really helps young people and people of all ages really to make a personal connection. I think it's so important. I know all of us at the Holocaust Educational Trust are so grateful for you going into schools, and I'm very grateful for you coming on this new medium today as well. This is your first podcast, I understand, so thank you for that. And I should say to our listeners that as we were setting up for the podcast, Harry himself wanted to go onto the App Store on his Android device to download the 70 Voices podcast. So if he can do it, you can as well. I would encourage all of you to go to 70voices.org.uk and to download our app on for Android devices and iOS devices as well. And until next week, thank you for joining us from the Holocaust Educational Trust. This is Alex Moss. I've been joined this week by Harry Bibring. Thanks, Harry.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Holocaust Educational Trust podcast series. This series is just one of the ways in which the Trust promotes greater awareness about the Holocaust and ensures that it has a permanent place in Britain's collective memory. If you'd like to make a financial contribution in support of this work, or to learn more about our programs, visit us online at het.org.uk.